Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Welcome to the True Wealth Podcast, where we specialize in helping aspiring homeowners break into the real estate market and help investors create and build wealth through real estate. We will be sharing some of our best advice around real estate so you can purchase your first home or reduce taxes and achieve financial freedom. Your host, Sean Adeyemi, is a certified financial planner, mortgage professional. Financial freedom is possible when you have the right mindset, coaching, advice, and community. So, let's get real.
Welcome to the True Wealth Podcast. I'm your host, Sean Adeyemi. Today, we are joined by Dimitri. Dimitri is from Share. This is part four of our conversation on real estate investing in the U.S. The first part, we talked with Andrew discussing why the U.S. real estate market is something worth looking to. Part two, we had a conversation with Carmen on the different tax structures and the proper ways to or the different ways to hold your real estate if you do buy real estate in the U.S. And part three, we spoke again with Andrew talking about the different financing options available for Canadians who are looking to purchase real estate in the U.S. Part four here is with Dimitri, and we're going to be talking about the metrics to look for, profitable foundations, mastering real estate metrics for success. What are the kind of numbers you should be looking for? What do those numbers mean? Is this going to be profitable? Is it not going to be profitable? How do you ensure that you're going through this or you're going into real estate investing with eyes wide open and you're making the right decision for your family? Dimitri, how are you doing today?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to have this chat with you today. And yeah, look forward to everything we have to cover.
It's all about the numbers, right? If you're going to go into real estate, if you're going to buy real estate, whether that's in the US, whether that's in Canada, I'm biased right now. I'm not a fan of the Canadian market. So the US market looks very lucrative. Obviously, it has its challenges. It's had its challenges over the years. But I know people who have made money regardless of the market. And part of being able to do that is knowing your numbers. Numbers, numbers, numbers. It's got to make sense. So let's dive into the metrics. Purchase price, I think, is the first one that an investor needs to be mindful of, right? When you're buying real estate, the price has got to be right.
Definitely. I mean, you know, you always want to make sure you're getting in on the right basis. And there's a lot of tools, you know, you can use to really evaluate if you're paying the right price. Ultimately, mm-hmm. You know, real estate is a market-driven investment class. A lot of the times, you know what properties nearby are selling for, you know, what's the right price, but you have to be factoring in, you know, the property-specific elements as you evaluate opportunity on a case-by-case basis. And buying well is definitely a very big component of a successful real estate investment.
And one of the parts to buying for the right price is also based on location. And location plays a key factor in whether or not the purchase price you're paying is going to be profitable. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, obviously, you know, every market is going to have, you know, different drivers, you know, different fundamentals. And ultimately, you know, for a single family home, which, you know, is where we're focused, it's going to have different, you know, drivers from a rental standpoint. So how much are people paying in rent? So ultimately, you know, you want to make sure you're evaluating all of those factors, really, you know, focusing on, you know, both the macro drivers, the micro drivers, and making sure, you know, you're buying relative to what's, you know, what you're currently seeing in the market and what you see as kind of the forward-looking trends.
So when it comes to the different classes of properties, typically mm-hmm. the purchase price and the class of the property matters into profitability when it comes to what's the game plan. Is it cash flow? Is it appreciation? Can you talk about the different classes and the price ranges and why price is a big factor in determining what asset class or what type class of property you should be looking at?
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, you know, every investor is going to have, you know, different targets and, you know, a different plan in mind. So obviously, you know, with our clients, you know, what we do is, that's the first part we want to understand about them. What is the long-term plan? And what are their goals, their timelines, and ultimately how can we get there? And, you know, if someone is, you know, very focused on cash flow, you know, you're going to be looking for those higher yielding properties, right? We'll probably get into talking about, you know, cap rates and things like that, which obviously play into evaluating a real estate investment. But ultimately, you know, if you're looking for, you know, a higher cap rate, you know, you're probably buying potentially at a lower price point, you know, where, you know, you're generating more of that yield. And part of that comes with, you know, some of that risk, right? And ultimately, you know, what we definitely see is as you go higher on the, you know, cap rate, or in a sense, like, you know, higher on the yield that you're trying to get from the investment, you're typically getting into a riskier asset class. And those deals, you know, generally speaking, over the long term, we'll see less appreciation, right? They might be older properties. They may be, you know, in a smaller market. You know, we talked about already how market definitely plays into, you know, effect when it comes to pricing and the rent. So ultimately, you know, if you're buying something, you know, in a smaller market or in a more inferior location within a market or something more tertiary, you might be getting compensated with better yield, but you may be sacrificing some of that long-term appreciation. Now, on the flip side, if you're getting into, you know, a very desirable market, you know, very liquid, you know, once, you know, it's a newer property, so, you know, carries less risks associated with it, you know, those properties may be located in, you know, more desirable neighborhoods, right, with better schools, you know, more demand from, you know, both renters and buyers. And ultimately, that's going to drive competition, and that's going to potentially, you know, increase the price that you're paying for it. And ultimately, you know, you may, you know, you'll likely result kind of generating less cash flow or less yield off that type of investment. But over the long term, those, you know, location and market factors, you know, will tend to allow that investment to appreciate at a faster pace over the long term. So again, definitely, you know, important factors to consider, and something, you know, we evaluate with a client on a case-by-case basis to make sure what's, you know, most appropriate for them based on, you know, their access to capital, but also based on their risk tolerance.
So is it safe to say that typically, not in all cases, if the property's cheaper, most times you will probably generate more income, rental income, but less appreciation, because those are typically older neighborhoods and older houses. And then for the higher the purchase price for the property, the less the yield, the less ongoing income you're going to generate, but it also means potentially the higher the appreciation on the back end.
Yeah. Again, obviously not everything is, you know, as simple or as uniform as that. And ultimately, you know, when you look at the investments and you talk about a lower price and a higher price, you know, there's limits to that. Like you still want something that is, you know, a, you know, single family rental, right? You know, a property that is best utilized, you know, for an investor as a rental versus, you know, going into maybe like, you know, higher price points where we're talking luxury or certain markets, which will have different fundamentals. So factoring that in, you know, if you kind of look at, you know, where our target properties are in these different profiles of homes, A, B, and C is how we group them. You know, we're still kind of, you know, at the high end, we'll be pushing maybe, you know, $400,000 purchase price, right? So if you kind of constrain your, you know, your framework with that in mind, then yes, you know, what you said is generally accurate. And that's how we typically see deals price out, especially kind of in the markets that we're in.
That was my follow-up question. Like, do you have a ceiling that you would typically look at in terms of purchase price, just so that we can still keep those numbers in line? And you said, typically you look on the high end 400K, which sounds about right. And the low end, I guess it all depends on not the price alone, but just the ability for that property to still generate a little bit of appreciation on the back end.
Yeah, look, even if we're getting into, you know, the lower price point markets and, you know, deals that, you know, will generally have more risk associated with, we're still selective on where we're buying, both from a macro standpoint, but also from the neighborhood and the street it's on and so forth. But ultimately, we're going up to up to like in and around 400,000 in some cases. And then on the low end, again, it will really be dependent on the market and ultimately, on our clients' financing strategy, because you need to be at a certain kind of quality of product and a certain price point to actually be able to get financing.
So then that
kind of gets into the all cash buyers or, or not approach as well.
Right. Because the less desirable the property is from a price point and marketability standpoint, the harder it is to get financing typically. So that means that you may have to, in those cases, probably see if you can buy the property cash, because maybe it needs a lot of fixing, it needs a lot of upgrades, financing becomes more expensive. And so it's better to probably just buy cash, clean it up a little bit, and then maybe put it back, refinance it so that now you can go to traditional lenders to finance it before you now put it into the rental market and you could probably even generate a lot more rental income using that type of approach, which goes to our second question, rental income.
And definitely, and just to kind of add to what you're just alluding to is, there's obviously the component of, the deal has to be in the right, physical condition to actually have a lender, provide you the financing. On top of that, there are just, minimum loan amount requirements from lenders. So again, if on the low end, if, we have a partner that will not lend, less than $75,000 on a, debt service coverage ratio loan, then, you can't be buying an $80,000 property, right? Because it's not going to meet their down payment requirements forth. So again, you might have that property be livable in the right market and generally be okay for financing, but you'll run into some constraints there as well. So a few kind of key things for people to keep in mind as they explore opportunities.
So rental income, obviously that's a big thing that most people are familiar with. Can my property generate enough rent to cover my expenses, my mortgage, my property taxes? Let's look at that a little bit more detail from a detailed perspective. Beyond just the income, potential rental income, what other facets do you typically explore when you're viewing this metric?
Yeah, I always it's a great question, because I know a lot of the times in the industry, and a lot of people will look at what is the rent ratio to the purchase price you're paying. And again, not that that's a bad metric to look at, but every market is different, right? And when you start factoring in large expenses, such property taxes, you're going to be paying very different property taxes relative to your purchase price or the value of your home in Texas versus Alabama, right? So if you looked at just the rents of the properties relative to the prices and compare an apples to apples on that case, you're not going to have the same cash flow generated relatively, because there's going to be, a lower net income generated from the property. So it is important to really, be granular and actually factor in the, the various, expenses and allowances that are going to be applicable when you own the investment. And again, we definitely try to, underwrite as granular as we can. A lot of times you are making allowances because things don't necessarily work in a straight nature, and you're going to have variability year over year. But when you look at things from a long term, from a long term viewpoint, and ultimately when you look at, the law of averages on a large portfolio, you can get some good benchmarks on where operating metrics need to be, and where you need to be accounting for on the expense side and on the allowance side. So, for instance, you're looking. I just kind of wanted to list out a few of them, right? So you're obviously looking at where are the rents, how does that compare to, the market, the properties, and so forth. But you are, allocating a vacancy allowance, right? There's always going to be some properties that are running vacant in the market, and different markets will have different vacancy factors, right? So you want to account for that every year. It's like I said, it's never going to be the number that you estimate, because some years you're going to be fully occupied and some years you might have 30 days to you know, reach out in the proper, but ultimately over the long term, you know, you're applying a vacancy factor every year. You know, you want to look at, you know, what are your taxes, right? Now, a lot of counties will reassess, right? So you want to factor in your purchase price and, you know, what the burden you're going to be paying, you know, every year for the realty tax assessment. You want to know what is it going to cost you to insure the property, right? So you want to factor in the insurance costs. You want to have an allowance for repairs and maintenance and, you know, have some reserves allocated into your cash flows. You know, if you're utilizing, you know, third-party property management, you need to know what are the fees you're paying? What is their structure? And a lot of times, you know, they're taking a percent of rent.
Right.
And that's what people are kind of estimating when they look at, you know, the property management expense. But we all know property management contracts also have leasing costs and renewal costs.
That's
right. You want to allocate, you know, some of that, because if you're placing a new tenant, you're not going to see the full year of those rents. You want to, you know, factor in costs that are associated with that. Obviously, you know, utilities, right? Most of the time in our markets, the tenant's paying utilities. So you will think, hey, that's, you know, zero, but it's not, right? There are going to be periods of times when you're doing renovations, when you're doing, you know, leasing, where the owner is going to be paying for those deals. Maybe they're not, you know, very large or overly material, but again, you want to make sure, you know, you're factoring that in. And, you know, hopefully I'm not forgetting any, but that's typically, you know, kind of all the line items that we break down as we look to estimate, you know, that net operating income and ultimately evaluate the cap rate that we're buying the opportunity at.
So let's explain what the net operating income is. I know we've kind of talked about it, but let's break it down for the newbie investor. What's the net operating income?
So it's basically looking at your rental revenue less your operating expenses. So again, really focusing on, you know, what is the income that is being generated by the property, right? So again, that will be kind of inclusive of all the items I had just mentioned. And I specifically, you know, stopped short of talking about, you know, some other items that are included overall in your cash flow, you know, when you talk about debt and so forth, you know, asset management fees, et cetera. But from a net operating income, it's, you know, the word operating is key. It's really your rental revenues less, you know, what your, you know, operating expenses are.
Right. And so typically when investors are looking to buy rent investment real estate, I always say treat it as a business, right?
Mm-hmm.
What's the cost for me to generate the revenue that I need to generate? So if I need to generate $2,000, or if I'm generating $2,000 from this rental property, what is it costing me on a monthly basis to do that? So those are the things you mentioned: vacancy rates, property taxes, property management, insurance, maintenance, leasing costs. And these all have different variations in terms of what you apply. Vacancy rates could be different, could be anywhere. Typically, I see, at least on the Canadian side, 10 to 20% vacancy rates. Different counties, different states have different vacancy rates. And so each of this operating expense have different metrics with which you use to apply an estimate. And like you said, it's never going to be a perfect number to use, but we look at law of averages when we're looking at these expenses.
Yeah, I think that's a very high vacancy rate. So typically, you know, you're not underwriting that. Again, if you look at kind of where the markets operate, right? Like ultimately, again, you know, with vacancy, yes, if your tenant turns and you have to do, you know, some work on the home and then get it released, it may take 30 or 60 days or so forth, you're going to have that, you know, vacancy percentage you just mentioned. But ultimately, you know, generally speaking, you see tenants in single family rentals staying for, you know, a number of years. So you know, residential space, you know, typically what we're seeing are markets operating in the, you know, high 90s, maybe, you know, like 96, 97% down to kind of the low 90s where, you know, maybe on the high end, you're applying an 8% vacancy factor. You know, there's data, you know, there's a lot of large institution that owns scale that are reporting their metrics public. There's, you know, research that's done to really kind of understand, you know, the, you know, where the market's operating at. So you kind of use those, you know, averages from, you know, a large set of data and really, again, allocate an annual allowance. Ideally, it's always occupied and you get that tenant that stays there for your entire duration,
which is four years, five years.
Yeah. A lot of times longer as well, because, you know, part of the reason that makes the, you know, the asset class attractive from an investment standpoint is obviously the affordability challenges that you see. And, you know, people having to rent more than they can afford home purchases, which, you know, makes the rental product very important to provide, you know, people with a quality living situation.
So let's look at the different return metrics, right? So we've mentioned a few terms here that I want kind of defined for the average investor, for the new investor. What's a cap rate? What's cash on cash? Everybody knows return on investment. That's pretty simple. But let's break down this other term so we know what to expect.
Yeah. So a cap rate, I mean, that's really kind of the universal tool in the world of real estate investing for, you know, evaluating a real estate deal. So it's what it's really looking at is that net operating income, right, which we just defined, relative to the purchase price. And really, the purchase price should really be your purchase price. And then the cost of any, you know, deferred maintenance you're doing to the property to actually get it into the condition at which it's rented, right? So we would call it, you know, your all-in cost. So purchase price plus renovations.
Plus renovations, plus closing.
Yeah. Usually closing, you don't typically include, it varies. We don't typically include because, again, it will vary. Like that's something that will vary a little bit based on the owner, you know, the structure they're buying in.
Right, right.
To a certain degree, you know, are they getting financing or not? It's meant to kind of really straight line. So you can compare, you know, a single family home investment on a cap rate basis to a, you know, office building on a cap rate basis, right? It is that universal tool that allows you to really price and understand things, you know, compared to each other. And ultimately, you know, if you're buying at a higher cap rate, you know, you're getting more net operating income. And if you're buying at a lower cap rate, you're getting less.
That's right.
A big driver in that, you know, cap rate, really understanding it is to some degree your risk return, but also the growth that you foresee in the investment, right? So an investor will pay a lower cap rate if they feel it has better growth in that investment.
Correct.
Ultimately, and that kind of ties back to our conversation right at the start about, you know, higher yielding properties, you know, a little bit more risky, lower yielding appreciation, and so forth, is ultimately, you know, if you're buying at a lower cap rate, but you, you know, see rents, you know, really skyrocketing in that area or in that market over the next 3, 5, 10 years, you're willing to pay that lower cap rate. Right. And obviously, you know, the actual real estate investment type factors into it. You know, you'll pay a lower cap rate for, you know, a residential property, you know, versus, you know, maybe, you know, a suburban office or et cetera.
Right.
So again, obviously that, you know, risk and growth potential factors into the calculation. And that's why the cap rate is really a key metric. Because again, it also, you know, just to kind of allude to it one more time, is it strips away, you know, the deal specific, you know, structures and financing, et cetera. It really just looks at the underlying real estate aspect of things. So, you know, what is your all-in cost and what is the net operating income you're generating?
Got you. So there's also return on investments. I'm not going to go into that, but let's talk about cash on cash return. What's this? How do you calculate that? And what's the significance of that?
Yeah. So cash on cash is, you know, taking, you know, that cap rate and going a little bit further with it. But again, now you're really assessing the profitability of the investment. So now you're looking at, you know, what is the cash I'm generating from this investment? And that's going to be now, you know, net operating income, like you're taking away, you know, what is that, you know, interest and principal expense you're paying? You know, in our model, you know, we, you know, asset management costs are included in, you know, cash flow. Really kind of getting down to your net cash flow number. But now you're looking at it, you know, not based on purchase price or your all-in cost. You're looking at it based on the equity you invested. So, you know, more often than not, you're not buying real estate, you know, full cash, right? There are reasons to do it. And, you know, today's climate is definitely, you know, getting more people to, you know, temporarily hold things that are on all cash basis. But ultimately, you know, in general terms, you know, you're using leverage. You're trying to use someone else's money to, you know, scale your portfolio and purchase the property. So the cash on cash really evaluates the profitability based on, you know, the cash you're getting out of the investment relative to the cash you put into the investment.
So with the cash on cash rate, you're factoring in your cost of acquisition, you're factoring in the other aspects to that whole deal. So financing costs, principal and interest. Right. If your down payment is coming from a HELOC, then you're factoring your interest rate that you're paying on that. So you're factoring all the other ancillary costs outside of just the specific property itself.
Mm. Exactly. And it's a great, it's an important tool because, again, you know, you might be looking at two different investments. You might be getting different financing terms on them. Some may require more cash to put down. Some may be in a market that has, you know, higher costs, you know, whether it's title or so forth, right? You're really kind of going down to that, you know, profitability comparison basis where you can, which one is going to be generating me a better cash on cash return, especially if that's, you know, what you're really factoring as, you know, the key metric for your decision. And obviously, there are, as we've talked about, there are multiple things to look at when you're deciding which property to buy and where.
Mm-hmm. I think for the newbie investor or somewhat seasoned investor, I think the cash on cash rate is a really good metric to look at in terms of long-term projections, especially because if at the beginning you're starting out and you don't have a lot of cash, it also means you're applying a lot more leverage. It's important to do your due diligence to ensure that that leverage and all the other aspects of the financing are factored in to help you make a good informed decision. So we've talked about NOI, net operating income. We've talked about cap rate. We've talked about cash on cash rate. Any other metrics you want to touch on?
Yeah. So I think what you just said about cash on cash is important. It's accurate. But again, you know, the cash on cash will have some limitations in the way it kind of looks at things, again, being, you know, ignoring really the aspect of time value of money, which is why, you know, when we look at things, you know, obviously cap rate, as I mentioned, is a big, you know, big metric that we're focused on. But really, when you look at returns, you know, we're focused in on a metric that is, again, more comparable with, you know, the ROI, but it's called IRR. IRR, return. Really, it's like your, like you said, internal rate of return. And that's really looking at things similar to a cash on cash, but it's factoring in the time value of money. So you're looking at, you know, what am I, you know, what is my outflow of cash initially? What am I putting into this investment? And then, you know, at each time period, what am I estimating that I'm going to have as cash outflows? Cash outflows. So, you know, that's, again, your net operating income after you're looking at, you know, principal and interest, some management expense and so forth. And looking at that, you know, as it grows over, you know, your investment period horizon, let's say it's 10 years, and then estimating, you know, what am I going to get as, you know, my disposition proceeds. And then saying, you know, what the IRR really calculates is if you lay it all out, and again, you use Excel, it's a more kind of, you know, sophisticated formula, but you're basically calculating that discount factor that will take all of those, you know, cash ins and outs over the whole period to a net present value of zero. So basically saying, you know, what is the return you're getting on that initial cash outflow every year based on this investment? And again, this allows you to, you know, A, really compare investments side by side, not just within, again, within single family, but, you know, across other classes, really factor in, you know, risk return, but also allows you to kind of understand, you know, what you're doing a little bit better. Because, you know, to your example, if you're buying a home ed with equity line of credit that's at a, you know, 7 or 7.5% interest rate per year, right? Like, and you're getting an IRR of 5% per year, like, that's not good, right? You're putting out 7.5% money and generating 5% per year, right? You want to make sure you're kind of, you know, generating or anticipating to generate a return on investment that's going to be, you know, better than what you're going to be able to do, you know, elsewhere, and also better than your cost of capital, or in a sense, you know, the risk-free, you know, interest rate that you might get from a savings account, right? So, again, that's why we really focus on IRR. And again, that's really kind of that institutional metric that you will see, you know, used by, you know, the large pension funds, the large asset managers. And that's really, you know, in a lot of cases, how people are compensated, right? Is, you know, above the annual return that you're generating is when, you know, the asset manager will take like a portion of profits, et cetera. And that's, again, a key indicator on why it's a very important metric. And again, every one of them has their limitations. Nothing is, you know, the only thing you should focus it on. But ultimately, you know, that's a key one that, you know, we underwrite our deals on and ultimately, you know, use to compare investments and, you know, markets and different types of profiles of homes.
I like the RR because it allows you to make an objective call on, okay, do I do real estate investing? Do I do stock market? Do I do both of them? Do I invest in private equity? Do I invest in private businesses? Do I invest, like, what's my total return compared to my outlay? And I can compare it to what, there's also the opportunity cost of doing absolutely nothing, not investing
and, in risk. And the risk associated with each of them, right? So, right. Obviously, if you're getting into a riskier investment, you should be anticipating a better IRR.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think this is a conversation that there's so many layers that we can peel and we can talk about and probably go nerd out on. But just to make it very simple, these are the at least four or five simple metrics that at the barest minimum you should be looking at. You should be looking at your rental income, you should be looking at NOI, you should be looking at cap rates, cash on cash rates, and IRR rates. And I believe this has been very informative. Dimitri, was there anything else you wanted to add to this before we wrap up?
No, I mean, I think, you know, in terms of the metrics, we definitely covered, you know, the key things. Again, I think it's always important for people to, you know, do their diligence on their investment, really kind of understand, you know, what are their, you know, internal preferences, internal goals. Ultimately, again, you know, you made a good point, you know, evaluating investments against each other. Do you want to go real estate? Do you want to go equities and so forth? I think, you know, we're very big believers in diversification. I think that's always important to say. And obviously, you know, in our realm, that's, you know, within the single family investment space, but I think that should be applied even more globally on an individual basis. But, you know, from our sense, right, like we, you know, when we help our clients build a portfolio, you know, part of why, you know, we set out to do what we're doing, part of, you know, the value I really feel like we're adding as our clients invest to it is the ability to, you know, instead of buying, you know, three properties in your backyard, actually have, you know, three investment properties that are in three different markets that have different drivers that may have, you know, things that, you know, you can't foresee. We don't know where the next big job announcement is going to be or, you know, which area is going to, you know, change some tax laws that will make things more advantageous, right? So having that diversification and ultimately allowing yourself to ride out some of that, you know, market by market volatility that you're always going to see, right? Rents are going to rise faster in certain years than other years, especially, you know, in, you know, areas where, you know, there's, you know, supply and demand equilibrium and you know, when things are really good, there's more stuff being built when things are bad, right? Riding all of that out and having that diversified portfolio is key. And I think that's why it's important to work with, you know, people that are knowledgeable in the space, you know, having mentors, having, you know, people that you can really, you know, look to help guide you as you make those decisions. And I just wanted to make sure I mentioned that because, again, I think that's very important. And that's something I definitely follow myself as I invest.
Absolutely. And that's why I believe this partnership works, because while Share is looking at the different metrics within the real estate markets, within the, and even diversifying within real estate, True Wealth, myself as a financial planner, I'm looking at not just real estate, but I'm also looking at, as much as I love real estate is not the only thing I tell my clients to invest in. It's also having that outside diversification. And we're able to look at the full big picture from where you're coming as an investor, what's good for you. Does real estate play a role in your overall portfolio? And if it does, what does that look like? And even within real estate, how do we make sure you're diversified? And that's part of what Share does to help you give you this holistic investment opportunity to help you build and grow wealth.
Yeah, definitely.
Dimitri, thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it. You and I can probably go ham on this numbers.
Definitely. Thank you so much for having me. It was a blast, and I'm glad we got to dive into all of these metrics.
Thank you very much. You've been listening to True Wealth Podcast. Talk to you next time.
This is all the time we have for today. Thanks for listening to the True Wealth Podcast. Don't forget to rate, share, and subscribe to the True Wealth Podcast on your favorite podcast platform. Follow us on Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook at True Wealth Pod. We'd love to hear from you. Share your thoughts, ideas, and questions with us on our social media platforms or email us at podcast@truewealthadvisors.ca. And who knows, your question might be the subject of a future episode.